You're listening to Richard Ellis Talks with Richard Ellis. If you're looking for some encouragement, words of hope, and maybe a laugh or two, that's exactly what Richard wants to share with you today. We know life can get pretty busy and complicated, so we're truly grateful you've chosen to take a break and listen to the program. Now, if you're not able to hang out with us for the entire program, you can always pick it back up at our website, richardellistalks.com. In fact, you can find all of Richard's talks right there waiting just for you, richardellistalks.com. So, with today's talk, here's Richard Ellis.
The title of today's message is Coup de Grâce. One of the things that I'm so fascinated with about the scriptures, and there's no way you're going to know this unless you read them, unless somebody just tells you, but the Old Testament especially, and there's great stuff in both, but the Old Testament is filled with battles. And it's just battle after battle, war tactics. You go back and look at the history of wars. Great generals would read the Bible, and one of the reasons they'd read the Bible is to study war tactics and how the enemy would ambush or come from behind. But the one thing they cannot factor in, unless you have a relationship with God or you're His people in the case of Israel in the Old Testament, is that they could cry out to God and miraculous things would happen. Now, I'm not saying that God doesn't intervene in battles along the way and things that are clearly, whether it's weather, some obstruction of some kind, something can happen. God is still in control, ultimately, and sovereign. It doesn't matter how many of them and how many of you or what the odds are. This isn't about odds. If you will trust God, follow Him, walk with Him, it isn't about odds. It's about God being able to intervene and do anything. It doesn't matter what you're up against. Now, I want you to turn in your Bible to Judges chapter 9, verse 50. And I'm reading, I'm going to pull some stories here to give you some examples, believe it or not, of coup de grace in the Bible. Judges 9, 50. Then Abimelech went to Thebez, and he encamped against Thebez and took it. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it. And he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. So these people are fighting for their lives. She's up in a tower, she takes this millstone, and they're throwing whatever they can to protect themselves, and it hits Abimelech in the head, doesn't kill him, but crushes his skull, and he's down. Then he called quickly to the young man, his arm bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed him." Now they had a little ego, a little macho thing back then. "I'd rather die by you than some woman throwing a rock at me and dying that way." So he says, "Draw your sword and kill me." Now, what is this described? There's a French term for this, and it's coup de grâce. And let me read you the definition, and we'll continue this passage. A coup de grâce is a brilliant, well, it's a death blow or death shot administered to end the suffering of one mortally wounded, a decisive finishing blow, act, or event. And it literally means in French, a stroke of mercy. So Abimelech is laying there. He's been hit in the head with this millstone. He's begging his arm bearer, the guy that helped him carry his armor around, "Kill me. I don't want anybody saying I died, that a woman killed me." So his young man thrust him through and he died. Now guys, there's amazing human stuff that goes on here. And one of the things is being an arm bearer and Abimelech there, the guy that's leading the army, and he says, "Kill me." And you have to literally take your sword and kill the guy at his request. These are tough times, tough situations to face. So his young man thrust him through, he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man to his place. And you can go read the context and what follows there. Part of the reason Abimelech got in trouble is he didn't do what God told him to do. This is a recurring theme in the Bible. You can get in trouble for trusting God, I'll grant you that. But why get in trouble unnecessarily? Go to God, stay with God, trust God, do it His way. Then if something goes wrong, at least you know it's not something you're doing, it's something God's allowing, probably, to teach you something. Stay in your lane. All right, go over to 1 Samuel chapter 18. There's another story, a situation similar to this, and we're going to go through a number of things in this passage and in the chapters following. There's something in terms of friendship, and even it's a military issue as well, but there's two guys in the Bible. One is King David, who before he became king was just a kid who slew a giant named Goliath in a battle where the odds were completely against him as well. And Saul was king at that time. And the bottom line here is Saul got really jealous of David. And if you keep reading in 1 Samuel 18 and following, Saul tries to kill him, is out to kill David because he's basically jealous and doesn't like it that it looks like God's with David and he's not with Saul, and Saul was exactly right, and he'd been told that, that God had withdrawn himself from Saul. But Saul has a son named Jonathan, and somehow, and I'll read you this in a second, somehow David and Jonathan became unbelievable friends. And it starts talking about this in verse 1 of chapter 18, 1 Samuel. Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. And this is a traditional thing that they would do, but they made a covenant, a verbal covenant, and then sealed it. Jonathan took, he's the son of the king, he takes his robe, his armor, everything off and gives it to David. They were friends. And I'll read you something in a few chapters from now about really how close of friends they were. Now if you keep reading through these chapters, a bunch of chapters, about 10 or so chapters, you come up to 1 Samuel 31. Go up there with me. 1 Samuel 31, and let's start with verse 1. It says, now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed, now look at this, killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. So Saul has lost three sons, and I don't have time to do all this, but I'd almost tell you to read the whole book of 1 Samuel, at least start in chapter 18, because at some point Saul does something really stupid. He gets worse all the time. Saul goes to a fortune teller, basically, and he's terrified that God's left him. He wants to know what's going to happen, and if you read it, people say, well, this stuff's in the Bible. Why can't we do it now? He gets a, it's more like a diviner of sorts, and she goes in, a medium is what they'll call it, goes into this medium and says, call up Samuel the prophet who had died. She calls up Samuel the prophet and he complains, why are you bothering me? Let me rest. I'm gone. What do you want? And he says, what's going to happen to me? And Samuel says the same thing. He says, the same thing I told you before. You're doomed. You're in trouble. Now, this is heavy duty stuff. Saul crossed the line and he got information, but it was the same information he was going to get. He should have gone to God. He didn't. And that's part of the problem why people do this today. They should be praying and talking to God. They don't like what God's saying, so they're getting a second opinion. And the second opinion ain't very good. And if it is, it doesn't end up where you're supposed to be anyway. Back to the story. Verse 3, the battle became fierce. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded. So three of his sons are dead. He had four sons. One of them wasn't there. He survived it. Three sons are dead. Boom, just like that, Jonathan's gone. The archers are chasing King Saul. They got to take the king out. They hit him with arrows, and he goes down. Verse 4, then Saul said to his armor bearer, coup de grace. He didn't say that, but basically he's saying, take me out. Please have mercy on me. He said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. And the word abuse means torture me. Saul knew as the king that if the enemy got a hold of him before they killed him, they would take him apart piece by piece and literally torture him. These were wicked people. And he knew what happened to kings. Kings had their eyes gouged out. After they were dead, they cut them in pieces. They even did this, took their heads off. I mean, these people were heavy duty when it came to battle. There were not a lot of treaties in place at that time about how you dealt with the bodies of the dead soldiers. Verse 4 continues, but his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Now, why do you suppose he was a little bit afraid? How do you draw your sword and kill a king who at one point in his life had been anointed by God? Even if the guy wants to die and knows he's about to die and doesn't want to die at the hands of the enemy, the armor bearer will not strike him with mercy. He will not kill him in this case. His armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore, Saul took a sword and fell on it. Now, let me tell you something, guys. There is no way in the world I can begin to explain because I have no idea. But when you know you've been defeated in battle, you've gone to a witch doctor, whoever it was he went to, and got all this bad information, and it gets worse, and it says even in the place of the seance, whatever you want to call it, he fell on the ground. He was so terrified. This is a mighty king who is terrified because he knows God has abandoned him. And Samuel told him in that seance, you're going to die, your sons are going to die. I told him everything that was coming. But now he knows he's doomed. He doesn't want to be tortured and killed by these uncircumcised Philistines. So he takes his sword, puts it somehow up to himself, wherever they put it, and falls on his own sword to make sure he dies. because he's so afraid to fall in the hand of the enemy. Therefore, Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword. So now you got the armor bearer knows that Saul's three sons are dead. Saul now has committed suicide, basically, and it doesn't happen a lot in the scriptures, and I don't know who I'm going to say this for, and I'm not encouraging anybody to do this, but some people come and get off this thing. Well, if you commit suicide, you go to hell, right? You can't find me one verse in the book that tells that. Once you get in the family of God, you're in the family of God, no matter how you get taken out, either by somebody else or yourself, the grace of God covers even that. Now, I don't recommend that as a way to go, and clearly that's not God's plan for anybody's life. But Saul got in the wrong place, and so he takes his life. This armor bearer saw that Saul was dead. He also falls on his sword, and he died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. Now jump to 2 Samuel chapter 1, and this thing picks up and keeps going. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. And remember this, David was supposed to be in this battle that Saul was in, but the Philistines had a decent relationship with David because he had fled and escaped over there when Saul was chasing him. The Philistines said, we don't want you in our battle because you're going to get in a bad situation and you're going to have to fight with us. We're going to have to pick sides. You get out of here. So he leaves and goes back to fight another battle. David stayed 2 days in Ziklag, and on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, where have you come from? So he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. Then David said to him, how did the matter go? Please tell me. Now, what is he asking about? Whether he likes King Saul or not, he's still the king, and David has respected that. We've gone through this in other messages. He had two, at least, opportunities to kill King Saul and let him live. He let God deal with Saul. He says, how did the matter go? Please tell me. And he answered, the people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. Now, guys, I don't know who it is on the planet, who it is that you have almost a covenant with, where you've swapped armor, or whatever you've swapped, that is a friend like David and Jonathan were. And I'm not saying he wasn't upset when he heard that the king was dead, but when he said David and Jonathan are dead, think of that friend. It may be a mom and dad, it may be a sister, it may just be some friend, but when you found out or find out one day that person is dead, how does that strike you? This is what David was going through. Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. So David said to the young man who told him, how do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead? The young man who told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear. Now you'll have to notice something here. This guy starts making stuff up. This is not what happened because we just read what happened. He was leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. Now when I looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? So I answered him, I'm an Amalekite. Now where has David been chasing? This guy, you'll see in a minute, thinks he's going to tell David some story, not one of the Israelites. I'm not one of your guys that killed him. I had mercy, coup de grace, on this guy. And because of that, you should take me in and I should be endeared to you. He doesn't know that David's been out fighting the Amalekites. He doesn't feel good about the Amalekites. He said to me again, please stand over me and kill me. The guy is claiming, this Amalekite is claiming that King Saul said, please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. I'm about to die, but I'm still alive. Have mercy on me. So I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them here to my Lord. Therefore, David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. When back then, when somebody died or something terrible happened, they'd rip their clothes as a sign of grief. So they ripped their clothes. Everybody with him did the same, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Then David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? And he answered, I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite. So David said to him, well, how was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? How is it you just randomly could kill, and now you're still alive? Because see, the true story is, the armor bearer wouldn't kill him, but when the king killed himself, the armor bearer couldn't stand to live what the king did, so he killed himself. Then David called one of the young men and said, go near and execute him. And he struck him so that he died. So the guy's plan, you know, endearing himself to the king didn't work out very good. Now he's dead. So David said to him, your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Then David, now watch this, and I've gone back this week and read some stuff. If you go to the Arlington Cemetery sites or any site, you read poetry, things at memorials of any kind, the poems that come out of this stuff, after people die, moms losing sons, fathers losing sons and daughters, people dying in battle, you read this stuff, and this is what David starts to do. You'll see here in a minute. So David said to him, your blood is on you. Then David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow, and it's literally the title of this is the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, and this is a lost book. We don't have this book, but it's referred to in another passage as well in the scriptures, this book of Jasher that contains poetry, different things like we're about to read. And this is what follows. This is the song of the bow. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. In other words, where the Philistines are. So if they hear that this terrible thing has happened, they're excited because they won at the expense of these kings and the sons of the kings. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For the shield of the mighty is cast away there, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. Look at verse 25. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. Now look at this very personal piece coming out here with David towards Jonathan. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. Now let me read it to you again. I am distressed for you, my brother, Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. All he's saying here is I have never experienced love from a woman like I've experienced from you. That kind of covenant, that kind of bond, that type. You know, it is a terrible thing that love in our society, in our world, has to involve sexuality in some way. That it is not possible for a woman to love a woman in a way without there being some kind of sexual innuendo, or that a man cannot love a man in a way that surpasses anything and their hearts be so close. There are men I know, and there should be the case. This is not about whether marriage works and all these things or not. And there are guys in this room who have been in battlefield situations with another man, and there is a bond there that has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with having survived and held together in a situation that was life or death, and there is a bond that cannot be broken. They would die for each other and have almost had to do so. And at some point, as the family of God grows together because of what Jesus did, and we'll see that in a minute, there is a bond that's created. And Jesus didn't just talk about this bond. He took the heat. He took the bullet. He took the cross. He took it on himself. He died in our place. He called us his friends and laid his life down for that reason. All right, now jump, if you would, over to John 19. One other passage, and then we're done. And this same story is told in some other parts of the Gospels. But believe it or not, there's a coup de grace in the New Testament as well. And I'm taking you over to the crucifixion where Jesus died on the cross. And let's jump in here at verse 28. He's on the cross. Verse 28 says, after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, said, I thirst. Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. Now let me throw something in here. I'm reading you in the middle of a story now. This is the greatest battle ever fought in the history of the world right here. And there are some people in the army now, this ad campaign that they have out there says an army of one. It's not an army of one, it's an army that takes everybody, but it works, so they use it. Where it's like one soldier. This is an army of one. And this one soldier, this one captain, as the scripture describes him, the captain of our salvation, hung on a cross, seemingly doing no battle, but fought the enemy in such a way that he was able to say, it is finished. Tetelestai is the word, paid in full, it's done, it's over. The battle's over. Now, how did the battle end? The battle ended when he died, because when he died, everything was finished, everything was paid, sin was covered, death was covered, everything was covered. So he hangs on this cross, says, it is finished, bows his head, he gave up his spirit. Now look at verse 31. Therefore, because it was the preparation day that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken. Coup de grace. They're mean enough to get Jesus crucified, get him killed, but they're so worried about legal holidays and Jewish tradition that they're willing to be merciful. And even with something as excruciating and as torturous as a cross, these people still had mercy in this day. The Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Get them off these crosses for the holy day. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other, the two thieves, who was crucified with him. So they go, and what would happen, and I think I even have something about this, Lactantius, a writer back in this day, says that it was a custom to break the legs of criminals upon the cross, which was done, we are told, at the instep with an iron mallet. So you're hanging on the cross, they go to the instep of the foot, and an iron mallet, and break your feet so that you couldn't hold yourself up anymore on the cross. Your lungs would collapse, and you would die. So these soldiers come along, and these guys are probably pretty jaded. They've been crucifying people for a long time. They know how to do it. Take them out. They want them off the cross. They're not dead yet. We got to get them dead so we can go home, kind of thing. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Now, guys, I'm not sure how this worked on that day, but somehow these two thieves aren't dead yet, but Jesus is gone. Now, whether Jesus could decide the moment when he said it is finished and could give up the Spirit or the Spirit left, however the three of them worked it out, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit at this moment, in a way, it's a coup de grace from the Father's point of view. And he says, you know what? Enough's enough. Because it's done. Enough is enough. He's paid the price. He's out of here. Enough pain, enough suffering. It is finished. When they came to Jesus, saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And then John goes to the trouble to say this, and he who has seen has testified. John says, I was there, I saw it with my own eyes. Jesus was alive, and he died. He really lived, he really died. He was not, didn't just pass out. Jesus lived, and he died. I saw it. And he knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. For these things were done that the scripture should be fulfilled. Not one of his bones shall be broken. And again, another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced.
Richard will be back in a moment to wrap up today's talk. But first, I want to share a couple of thoughts with you. Let's be honest. Real life isn't about living some highlight reel for others to see. Most people have deep hurts, questions, and struggles. Well, we get it, and we want to help you in any way we can. So let's keep this conversation going. You can give us a call anytime at 855-6-RICHARD or connect with us at our website, richardellistalks.com. You can even put in your prayer request right there on the prayer wall. Call us at 855-6-RICHARD or online at richardellistalks.com. And now let's get back to Richard with a final word on today's show.
Now let me give you the ultimate coup de grace. And is what's made available to everybody in this room and listening beyond this place and anybody on the planet. It's a stroke of mercy. And God comes along and in one blow takes out your sin, your debt, my debt, what I deserve to pay, he takes it out with himself, a stroke of mercy. And all I have to do, all you have to do is go to God and say, God, there is no way, even if I could die, it would never cover my sin. Your death covered it. My death won't. If I die, I'm screwed. I'm in big trouble because of my life, my sin is still on me. I understand now. John wrote about it. I see people's lives have been changed by it. Father, I need this stroke of mercy in my own life. I need, even though I know I'm dead already, I feel dead. I live dead. I'm a walking dead man, zombie as it were. I'm existing. I'm not really living. God, I'm telling you, I want this same life and death and burial and resurrection that's been applied to so many other lives applied to mine. I'm a sinner. I've messed up. I need your mercy. I need your grace. And I believe Jesus died in my place to cover me, my sin. And I'm asking you to take my sin away, to forgive me, to cleanse me, to give me a new heart, a new life, a new mind, a new everything. Live in me, live through me. Thank you for paying my way.
Thanks for tuning in today to Richard Ellis Talks. With the busy schedule everyone has these days, it means the world to us that you would take this time to listen. Let us know how it has touched your heart by calling us at 855-6-RICHARD. You can also connect with us at our website, richardellistalks.com. One last thing, Richard Ellis Talks is a daily program, but also has daily costs. And being a listener-supported program means we rely on the financial partnership of our listeners, which means you. Maybe you've given to this ministry before or have waited for the right time. Well, we believe that these talks with Richard are making a difference in your life. So this is how you can make a difference to ours. You can contribute by giving us a call at 855-6-RICHARD or at our website, richardellistalks.com. Thank you for your very generous gifts. It truly means so much to us. God bless, and thanks for listening to Richard Ellis Talks.